I'm going to talk tonight about the women's movement in the United States, and that's an incredible amount of material. But before I get into it, let me just ask you this. When a woman complains, what is she called? Well, they call her a witch, and they burn her, or they call her a bitch, and they cast her out, or what else? Mad, and they lock her up. When a man complains, what do they call him? A great philosopher. Have you ever read Friedrich Nietzsche? What image do you have of the women's liberation movement? How many of you in this room actually identify with the movement? Raise your hands. Oh, a lot of you. Okay, how about those of you who didn't raise your hands? What image do you have of the women's liberation movement? Just call it out.
Short-haired, bitchy women.
What else?
I don't identify with movement.
You want to do it by yourself?
No. Can't identify with everybody who says there's women's movement.
Okay. What other image do we have of the women in the movement? You're frightened of people who are really political. Why? Isn't some of it that you have the feeling that people are telling you what to do? Is that some of it? Or is some of it that you have the feeling that the women's movement, as any movement, is asking you to be responsible for your own life? And that's scary? Okay, what image do you have of the women's movement in the 19th century? What do you think about those women? Bitches? No. No. What? Crazy? What else? What? Intelligent? Okay. What? What else?
Incredible.
Courageous people, right. Huh? Women bashing their heads against everything. Yeah. One of the images that we've been encouraged to maintain about the women's movement of the 19th century, I think, is the image of the sex-starved spinster, desperately unhappy, a woman who can't make a success of anything, or of middle-class women who are only concerned with developing a single issue, who don't really understand what the basic problems in American society are. All right, let me tell you how I see the women's movement. I see it as a fundamental social movement that is and has always been concerned with basic social change. And when I talk about basic social change, I mean change in all of the major institutions of this society. As such, the women's movement is and always has been related to other movements for basic social change. Even though many of the people involved have not been aware of it, because the women's movement is and has always been a very broad movement, various segments of it may seem unrelated. For instance, what about the middle-class woman who protests that she wants to go to work, that the only way that she'll be liberated is to get a job? And the working-class woman who knows damn well that she's not liberated through her job? Or the black woman who sees that part of the source of her oppression lies in the behavior and the role of the white women. Now, our problem in analyzing the women's movement is to see where these various segments of the woman's movement, the middle class women, the working class women, black, non-white women, where these various segments are related, to see if we can isolate common causes for the kinds of oppression that all of these different segments are experiencing. Okay. An analysis of the women's movement requires us to do the following. First of all, we have to figure out what are the ways in which women are oppressed. Who are the women who are oppressed? Which groups? Which different classes? Different ages? Different races? Different ethnic groups? We have to ask how this oppression, the oppression of the various groups of women, relates to other forms of oppression in this society, and try to figure out the kinds of relationships we can find. And as I say, see if we can find similar causes. Now, this part of analyzing a movement is known as identifying the enemy. Who is the enemy? And as you must be aware, there are many different definitions of who the enemy is. The third thing we have to do is look for the structural changes that have occurred in the woman's role, of her role in production, in reproduction, in the family, her basic role in society. How has this been changed? By structural changes in the society. And finally, we need to find out how women are responding to their condition. What groups are organizing? Who are the women who are organizing? What are the goals of their organization? Do these goals relate? Do they relate to the actual cause of their oppression? Or do they relate only to the symptoms of their oppression? We need to ask, are the women mobilizing power? And if so, how? Where are they finding power to overthrow their oppression? And finally, are they working with other movements? Do they identify the causes of their oppression with the causes of the oppression of other people? Okay, now as we said last week, as we began to talk about it last week, we need to look at all of this historically. We want to show that there is nothing natural. There is nothing natural about oppression. Now, in any society, the people who have control of that society are the people who tell the stories about what happens in that society. And they tell it so well, you see, that the status quo, which is their power, comes to seem natural. And therefore, because we're told it is natural, we don't question it. Now, the prime example of that is the definition of the woman. That the woman's role is biological. That means it's natural. That means there's nothing you can do about it. The woman's situation is a product of her biology. But of course, this story has been told by the men. As we said last week, history is his story. Now, the oppression of women in this society, in the United States society, is a direct result of the organization of this society under industrial capitalism and under a system of patriarchal familism. Now, you, I, all of us have been taught to think that the organization of your role, the kinds of behavior that's expected of you, is natural. But what we want to show in this course, by showing you different types of social organization, is that there are alternatives. And if there are alternatives, then by God, we can change this society too. The study, therefore, of women's story in this society exposes the picture of a white, male, ruling class. Now, in this society, the sacred symbol of all of that power is what?
Money.
Money. The sacred. You know what sacred means? You don't question it. You don't see it. It's hidden. You know what the sacred symbol in this society is? You're all afraid to say it. It's so goddamn sacred you're afraid to say it. It's the male penis. What's the symbol? When do you ever see a picture of a male penis? You see breasts all over the place. When do you ever see a penis? Look at the symbol standing over Washington, over our national capital. Look at the symbol on top of all the churches in the society. Okay, Antioch has a lot of them, doesn't it? Okay, the point is, this is a symbol to the great white father. This symbol also dominates our foreign policy. Speak softly and carry a big stick. Okay, the 19th century is the critical period for beginning our analysis of the women's movement. During this century, women began to organize to fight back. Why? Now, they certainly had protested in the past, and they had clearly been oppressed. For instance, millions of women had been burned as witches. And did you know, as a matter of fact, that the witch is a remnant of the worship of the goddess? Did you know that pitchfork that she carries and that broom that she carries are remnants of her role in the by the hearth, the goddess of the hearth, and the goddess of the field? And that when Christianity came, they defined the worship of this goddess as pagan, and as Christianity spread through Europe, millions and millions of women defined as witches, women associated with the hearth and the field, were burned. All right, my point is, these were strong women who did fight back, but they didn't get organized. They didn't get organized. Women have also been involved in every people's uprising throughout time. Whenever there's a people's revolution, the women, of course, are there. But during the 19th century, we begin to find certain structural changes in this society that begin to make the woman's role problematic. We find, as a matter of fact, that things are getting worse for women, not better, in terms of the kinds of restrictions placed on her role. And because of these structural changes, women were, in a sense, freed up to examine and to organize around what they felt was increasing oppression. So one of the first great myths that we have to examine, and in examining the women's movement, we try to examine every myth, because that's one of the things we must do when we talk about broad institutional change. Okay, one of the first myths is the one that was put forth by progressives in this society that said that civilization has been gradually evolving from lower forms to higher ones, and that things have been steadily getting better. In other words, if we just hold tight, that things are getting better, and with time they're going to get even better. Now, one of the best books that really does a smashing job of this from the woman's point of view is that book, The First Sex. I recommend it. All right, what was happening in the 19th century? Women were losing control over their role in production and in reproduction. Their role in the family was being defined in an increasingly rigid way. Now, let's look for a few minutes at the situation of women in colonial America, and then we'll come back to the 19th century. Now, the very early settlements and the moves westward were based on a very simple kind of social organization. Each family produced what it could for survival, and everybody worked all available hours. Although there was a rough division of labor between men and women, there were no rigid rules about this, no rigid rules keeping women from doing man's work if she had the time and the energy. But in this early period, the woman's labor was essential in the production of household goods, food, soap, candles, spinning thread, weaving cloth, making clothing. The women of this period had no legal rights, but they were valued for their labor. The legal position of women was that the man and the wife were one person, and that's the man. A married woman lost all rights. She lost her civil life. You know, the woman is veiled. Symbolism of the woman, femme couverte, losing her civil life. She can't sign contracts. She has no right to her own earnings. She has no right to property. She has no right to even her own children. If her husband dies, her children can be taken away from her. All right. As I say, the women in colonial America had no rights, but because their labor was needed, they had a relatively favorable position in that society. Now, the majority of the colonists in this country brought with them the European models for social relations. They accepted monogamous marriage, they built single-family houses, they assumed their right to own property. They became members of churches, they adopted this British common law, and they organized their marketing along European lines. Now, along with the common law, religion was extremely important in defining and maintaining the woman's status in the society. The church taught that woman's place was determined by God, that God had created man to have dominion over the earth, and woman out of Adam's rib to be a companion to man, that woman must always be subordinate to her husband, and that her limitations had actually been determined by God. In other words, her inferior status was predetermined by God. Women were tied in colonial America. They were tied to their role in the family. Single women were expected to live within a family household. There was no place, there was no room, there was nowhere for a single woman. Their labor was needed. Merchants rounded up women off the streets in England, out of the jails, and sent them to America to be sold as wives. That was going on as late as 1790. Yet women in colonial America were not only engaged in work relating to their family needs. Again, because there was a shortage of labor, they were publishing and printing newspapers. Some of them kept taverns. Often they took over the businesses of their husbands if their husbands died. But by the end of the 17th century, women had lost these positions. They were no longer able to take on these positions outside of the family. Now, the women who were the most exploited in early America were, of course, the slave and the bond women. Women who were kidnapped or sold out of prisons as indentured servants had at least the hope of some freedom if they survived. But those women who were brought from Africa as slaves had no such hope. The British, the French, the Portuguese, Spanish, American slave traders carried on a trade which provided labor for southern cotton and tobacco plantations and which fattened London, Liverpool, New York, Boston, Salem. Estimates of the number of slaves taken run over 20 million over a 200-year period. And there's little agreement on the number who survived, a half, perhaps a third. The slavers made warring raids on villages. They broke up the tribes, separated the families, marched the people through heat and rain for hundreds of miles, put them in slave pens on the coast, branded them, chained them, and then brought them on a passage of 4,000 miles. The trips were made in ships that were smaller than the Mayflower, with the, quote, cargo, chained in pairs to platforms with as little as 18 inches between the floor and the ceiling. And there they remained, except for very brief periods, to relieve themselves for 5 or 6 week voyage. 1/3 of this cargo was women. They were chained in separate rooms. They were packed in spoon fashion. They often gave birth during passage in the scalding heat down below the decks. The conditions were awful. There was no adequate provision made for waste. There was not enough food or water. Disease was rampant. The dead and the sick were thrown overboard. The female slave faced additional hazards. She was used for breeding purposes. She had no defense against the sexual advances of any white man. All right, that's briefly the condition in colonial America. Now, at the end of this period, during the revolutionary period, we begin to have a coalition of a number of different groups. The revolution was a movement of these many different groups. By the way, you've heard of Paul Revere. Have you ever heard of Sybil Ludington? She was a young woman of 16 years who rode farther than Paul Revere to warn the people that the British were coming. Okay. During the revolutionary period, as men talked to their freedom and inalienable rights, women and slaves, too, struggled to improve their situation. Mercy Warren was a woman who fought for the freedom of slaves, fought to get the Constitution to grant the freedom of the slaves, and she also fought for the equality of women. Abigail Adams, in a very famous letter to her husband John, she was up in her home outside Boston keeping things going, feeding the many, many travelers who were coming through, running her house, while John was down in Philadelphia having a great time fighting the revolution. She wrote him a letter asking him, begging him, to include the rights of women in the new laws that he was making. And of course his answer was no. In England in this period, Mary Wollstonecraft wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Women, stating that women also have the right of self-determination, and answering Rousseau, that great figure of the Enlightenment, who stated that women's education should prepare her to be useful to a man. After the revolution, the major economy in this country was still based on farming and trading. But gradually, some of the leaders began to recognize the importance of industry and wanted to get it started here. But there was still a terrible labor shortage. And so Alexander Hamilton and some of his buddies urged that industrialization would keep women and children out of mischief. That since it was important, since it was our duty to God to be diligent and to work hard, that women and children should form this first industrial labor force, which in fact they did. Women and children were the first workers in the textile industries. Now that brings us up very quickly to the 19th century and what I've called the worsening condition of women. Now first of all, let's look at what happens to her in the role of production. All right, what's going on now is the shift from a home-centered economy to an industrialized economy. Now, under capitalism, in this shift, all of the workers lose out. In the shift to wage labor, the workers do no longer have control of the profits that are made. All workers lose out, but women lose out in a very special kind of way. Now, women had formed the pool of surplus labor that was first tapped in this early process. But this is the work that they had been doing anyway. The women had been doing the work of weaving and spinning. Wealthy men bought the equipment, they bought the looms, and they set up large rooms with many looms. And the women went to work there because a woman at home could no longer compete with the kind of work that was being put out from the factories. Many women continued to work at home for pin money. The women who sewed at home sewed for pin money. Now, we've always heard, you know, the pin money is that little bit of extra money. But what it really means is the money that women earned when they sewed at home was so little. It was such a pittance. It was such a pittance. This is what pin money is. And yet this was the money the women had to live on. Anyway, women and children went to work in the factories. Spinning schools taught the women and children. The children had a spin. Inventors designed machinery to fit the hands, the little hands of the children. The very first workers in this country were thought of as pioneers in this great adventure. They were the daughters of farmers. And they were used to long, hard days. And they were used to the patriarchal rule, where they had little decision-making in the family, where if they weren't married, they were under the rule of their father or their brother. So in these very early days, the mills looked like a way out to many of these women, and they flocked to jobs there. Now, the mills were operated under a system of paternalism, which provided the women with boarding houses and a very strict code of moral conduct. In other words, the women were protected. At first, the work was not too bad, and it certainly was no harder than what they were used to. And it provided them with a little money, a very little, because they had to pay for their rooms in the boarding house, and the rents were very high. And this was one of the very first issues over which women became inflamed. But by the 1830s, industrialism was developing very rapidly. Technological improvements allowed greater efficiency and a speed up of the work process. No longer did this seem like an easy job. And a new rigid discipline destroyed the pseudo air of gentility that had surrounded the earlier days, making the mill girl's position less appealing for what was a rising middle class of women. Now, in the 1830s, the Depression destroyed many farms and forced many women into permanent factory jobs. What I'm saying also is, in the very early days, the women who came from farms had some choice. If things got too bad, they could leave. Generally, they worked 4 or 5 years and then they left. It was seen as a step onto bigger and better things. By the 1830s, this had all changed. As factory conditions deteriorated, the women who entered the mills were more dependent on this work. The poor women from the Depression, and later women coming in from Europe. An influx of foreign labor maintains competition for these low-paying jobs. So the mill, which had started out looking to middle class and working women as a step to broader opportunity, became a permanent experience of relentless oppression. Now, what have I said so far? That women in the early 19th century lost their major role of production in the home. They lost this role as the goods that they had made in the home began to be produced as consumer items. At the beginning of this process, middle-class women were involved. But by the 1830s, we have increasing separation between the classes. The middle-class women turn away from mill work. They go into the professions of teaching and nursing. And we find a redefinition of working women. Remember, we talked about colonial women and how they all worked. And there was pride. Women took pride in being workers. All women did. By the 1830s, we have a redefinition of the working woman. Now, the working woman begins to be judged as someone who has stepped out of her place. And the woman begins to be defined as she who works in the home. With the separation of the classes, the working and the middle classes, we find this changing definition of the ideal woman. The working class woman is no longer considered respectable. She becomes an object, a sexual object for men, while a new role is being created for the middle class woman, a new role in the home. Now, this role in the home woman in the home, continues to justify these very low wages paid to women who work outside the home. And it was true from the very beginning that the women workers in the mill made a third to a half as much as the men workers. And it was also true of the teachers. The women who worked as teachers and nurses made pittance. They made very little money. But as I say, the ideology around this was that women should be at home. The women who are demanding higher wages are not respectable women and therefore can be ignored. Now, in the professions, we find new rules which demand education as a prerequisite for working as professionals. This is particularly true in medicine. Women who had worked as midwives, and that was one of the large occupations for women, were now pushed out of their role. They were not accepted in medical schools. And education for women was defined, after Rousseau, as preparing women for work in the home, not for training her mind, which was believed to be smaller and inadequate. For the black woman during this period, her role in production was little different from the black man. They, of course, received none of the profits of their labor. And the institution of slavery kept wages for all workers low. All right, that's briefly the woman's role in production and how it's changed. Now, how about the woman's role in reproduction? The woman's role in reproduction. The black women were blatantly used as breeders. A woman who had had one or two children commanded a higher price because she was a breeder. She was defined as a breeder. Yet demand for an increasing labor force continued to keep pressure on all women to reproduce. Now, what happens to the middle-class woman? She is increasingly denied information about the whole process. Her new role in gentility means that she's kept ignorant. Now, I told you a few minutes ago that we no longer have midwives. Women are no longer controlling the whole process of reproducing. Now, men are taking over this process. Women are denied information about this. They are taught that it is not nice to talk about it, even privately. With the growth of this cult of what was called, it was called the cult of true womanhood, women are no longer supposed to enjoy sex. And the ideal pure woman was supposed to live a life of idleness. Now, her role was redefined. Her role was that of the ministering angel. And her role was to create a buffer zone
between the larger society
Now, men are taking over this process. Women are denied information about this. They are taught that it is not nice to talk about it, even privately. With the growth of this cult of what was called, it was called the cult of true womanhood, women are no longer supposed to enjoy sex. And the ideal pure woman was supposed to live a life of idleness. Now, her role was redefined. Her role was that of the ministering angel. And her role was to create a buffer zone between the larger society and the individual. In other words, the home was supposed to be the place to which the man could escape after the rigors of a day in the world. Now, her functions of producing in the home, as we've said, have already been taken away. But now her role is to create, to protect this home. we find a new definition of the bourgeois family reaching its height in the 19th century. We find it spreading to all classes. Women lose control over the process of reproduction. It's during this century that the laws against abortion are passed. The Catholic Church did not always oppose abortion. It was during this period that these laws were passed. It was during the 1800s that the Comstock laws were passed, which denied women access to any birth control information or any birth control gadgets. What is going on is the woman's role is being increasingly restricted, you see. She's lost control over production, she's lost control over reproduction, and her role in the family is increasingly restricted. Now, in the early part of the 1800s, there's a lot of discussion about the family. I mean, a lot of people are seeing that the family, the organization of the family is changing. And so you find these utopian socialists experimenting with different forms of family organization. Engels writes his book on the origins of the family in the middle of the 1800s. A lot of people were talking about the fact that the family had become a problem. But what I'm saying is that by the second half of the 1800s, discussion about this has been squelched. In other words, the bourgeois family is the model. It's the only way to live. The bourgeois family, in which the man works, the woman stays at home, and plays a so-called the role of the ministering angel, creates a buffer zone between the individual and the increasingly repressive society. The woman's role, new role, in the family is spelled out very rigidly. Fashion decrees what she should wear, a girdle, a corset that keeps her from breathing, that constricts her organs so that she can't function, bustle. She's tied down with clothes. Her language is restricted. She's no longer supposed to mention the parts of the body. She's not even supposed to eat a leg of chicken. You can hand her the breast, but call it the bosom. Now, any woman who complained about this was cast out, you see. The women had really no choice. Within the family, they had this role. Outside of the family, they could only get these pitiful jobs in factories or as teachers at really inadequate wages. The only hope for a woman was to get married, but her life as a married woman was, as we've seen, no picnic. And the women were expected to keep silence. The whole thing, the whole mess, was glorified and romanticized by a growing mass industry. The novels and women's journals. And these spelled out the ideal role for the woman. Now, it's also important to notice that the woman's new role includes a new role in relationship to her children. As she is denied sexuality, as she's denied any real participation in the world at large, so her role with her children increases, and she begins to hover over those children. Now, there's a reason for this, too. There's an expansion of the role of childhood. Young people, children, young adults are kept out of the labor force, and we begin to have a change in this, whereas children originally had worked in the labor force with a change with floods of immigrants coming in, the children of the middle classes were kept out of the labor force. And so the middle class and the upper class woman has a very special role in the socialization of her children. All right. In 1872, the Supreme Court upheld the refusal of the Supreme Court of Illinois to admit women to practice law. Now, its argument was the following. First of all, religion. Second of all, biology. In other words, women need special protection for childbirth. Women need, this is the Supreme Court, women are weaker. Women are a danger to morality, and men should have the power. And we see this reasoning continued up into the 20th century in the arguments for protective laws that keep women out of many occupations. Increasing restriction of women's role in the 19th century. In the 1860s, the Constitution restricted women from the vote. Before that time, in some areas, women had been able to vote. So here we have the position of women with no civil rights in the first place, and her economic position is worsening. All right, the stage is set for revolt. And the revolution comes in many ways. Some of the first organizing was done around the demand for good education, recognizing that education was essential for vocational choice, and it always has been. And don't let anybody kid you that an education should not be related to your preparation for a vocation. Women began to agitate with the working men, for a system of free public education. We have a coalition here of the women and the working men in the early 1800s calling for free public education. For the women, there was an especial need to recognize that her so-called inferiority was not the result of her smaller brain, but a lack of education. The women involved in this movement were Frances Wright, a woman from England. She was a radical. She went around the country giving lectures on the need for education, anti-slavery, many things. But she was concerned with the need for education. Maria Stewart was the first American woman to lecture on the subject. She was a black woman, Maria Stewart. She lectured up in Boston in the 1820s. Emma Willard opened a school for girls in Vermont to teach them algebra, geometry, natural science, and so forth. And then in the 1820s, set up the Troy Female Seminary, which is the first endowed institution for women. Now, by the mid-1800s, seminaries and colleges for women were beginning to be established. And women graduated from them with their minds open to new ideas. In other words, the women went to the colleges, they began to, they got together, they talked about problems, and out of these colleges came a whole generation of feminists who were actively involved in organizing the women's rights movement later in the century. Now, the major political issue of the first half of the 1800s was slavery. The abolitionist movement has been called the storm center for a whole series of mass democratic movements of blacks, of workers, of women. These groups built an alliance that increased in power up until the Second American Revolution or the Civil War. The blacks' fight for freedom furnished all of the issues for justice, for equality, for liberty, for decent pay. And the women who got involved in this fight, the white women, began to learn about fighting for rights. The black women and the white women together developed a strong spirit of cooperation. Black women, Sojourner Truth, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, Sarah Douglas, Mary Carey, Grace Maps. Who have I left out? Who was called the Moses of her people? Okay. Harriet Tubman. A great black woman leader of the, she was a slave of the abolition movement. White women included Lucretia Mott, the Grimké sisters, Lydia Child, Lucy Stone, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, to mention a few. Now, at the founding convention of the Anti-Slavery Society in 1833, the men who were there did not ask the women who were there to sign the society's declaration. And women's rights began to become an issue within the abolition movement itself. And the women set up their own society. Now, the women's meetings were often mobbed. They were mobbed by angry citizens, angry over, first, the fact that women, as women, are getting together to talk about things, and even more so that white women and black women are getting together to talk about changing the system. As white women went around the country speaking out against slavery, ministers, citizens, established citizens, were outraged at these women speaking out in public. They called them all kinds of things, harlots and all the rest. What right did these women have to speak out in public? This was a very radicalizing experience for all of these white women. They got into the abolition movement, and they began to discover that their own rights were just about almost as restricted as those of the black. They began to discover that there was that they needed to do something about their own position in society. In 1840, at a convention in London, Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were outraged because they weren't seated. They had gone over to the convention. Lucretia Mott is a delegate, Elizabeth Cady Stanton with her husband, who was a delegate, and the convention refused to seat these women. And the two women, Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, went out on the streets and they walked and they talked about what a deplorable situation this was. And they decided that the time had come for them to organize a women's rights meeting. And they pledged that they would do that when they got back. Well, now, it was 8 years later before they actually got around to it. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was busy having children, and Lucretia Mott was traveling around the country speaking out against the institution of slavery. But in 1848, in Seneca Falls, was held the first women's rights convention in the world. Now, their Declaration of Sentiments was based on the Declaration of Independence. Reading in the beginning, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal." And going on, "The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her." And then they listed all their grievances. And one of their major grievances was marriage. They saw marriage. There was no question in their mind that marriage was the major source of their oppression. Their grievances also included the fact that they had to submit to laws that they had no part in making, that they had no property rights, that they had no right to divorce, had no civic rights, they couldn't get jobs. When they got jobs, they were poorly paid. They couldn't get a decent education, and they didn't have the vote. The vote was kind of a minor issue at this convention. In the 1850s and the 1860s, following this, there were many meetings around the East to organize women's rights, a women's rights movement. And at one such meeting in Akron, Ohio, when the middle-class women were ridiculed, saying by a minister who stood up and said, "What's the matter with you white women? You have the best seats in carriages. People help you over ditches. You have the best of everything." And at that point, a great, great black woman came up from the back of the convention hall, and she asked to be allowed to speak, and she said, "Look at me. Nobody ever helped me into a carriage, and nobody ever helped me over a ditch, and nobody ever gave me the best place, and ain't I a woman?" And then she held up her right arm and she said, "Look at my right arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as any man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most of them sold into slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman?" And when the meetings of the white and black women were mobbed, the women linked arms and they made their way out together. And what I want to emphasize is during this period, the growing solidarity between the white women and the black women. And while these women were organizing their meetings, working class women were also organizing. And they were organizing for better pay and shorter hours. Now, let's look a little bit at what happens to working women. During the 1830s, this is when we begin to have this division in the classes, the women in the factories began to become involved in trade union protests against this very fundamental organization of work. And they formed the factory girls' associations, which attracted large membership. By the 1840s, the Lowell, Massachusetts, that is, Female Reform Association, headed by Sarah Bagley. Sarah Bagley was the first women's union leader. They put out a paper, The Voice of Industry. And on March 8th in 1857, the women garment textile workers on the Lower East Side of New York staged the demonstration. March 8th, what's that? Okay. And the textile garment workers are still striking, by the way. Their conditions are still lousy. At our celebration this last time, we had two women from the Farrah plant. The Farrah plant makes blue jeans, and the workers were fired because they tried to organize a union. And so these women are going around the country urging people in this country to boycott Farrah pants. All right, it all started way back then. Now, during the Civil War, the women became involved with many jobs that had formerly been held by men. Now, there's a basic pattern that we see throughout our whole history relating to wars, and that is whenever there's a war, there's a demand for women workers. And after the war is over, those women lose their jobs. And after the war is over, there's also a period of repression of the leaders who have organized movements for change. We see this basic pattern. It's very clear in the Civil War. The Civil War, many women went into industry, and they also fought in the Civil War. They fought in the war. And, of course, the greatest of all these was Harriet Tubman, the Moses of her people. This woman had led hundreds and hundreds of people out of slavery, and she'd organized the escape of thousands. She was the chief conductor on the Underground Railroad. In the Civil War, she became a general, and she led an expedition into Southern Territory, an expedition that was completely successful. It took Harriet Tubman years after the war to get any kind of a pension because after all, she was a woman, and a black woman at that. After the Civil War, we have this period, the women lose their jobs, and we have a period of increasing repression, and we have a split. We begin to have a split between the black movement and the women's movement. What happens? It all comes up over the 14th and 15th Amendments. These amendments are supposed to grant rights to the blacks, to grant them all the rights of citizens, and to grant them the right to vote. But these rights are restricted to male, to the males. And so for the first time, the word male is written into the Constitution. Now, some of the women of the women's movement were madder than hell over this. They didn't think it was right. They didn't think it was necessary. You know, why settle for this? Why not go all the way and demand universal suffrage, demand universal rights? They thought that's what the whole thing had been about. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were leading the group of women who were very upset. It caused a split in the women's movement, and it caused a split, as I say, between the people supporting the rights for the blacks and the people supporting women's rights. The basic split meant that the women's movement, the women's rights movement, split into two basic groups. Lucy Stone headed up one. She and her group stated, this is the Negro's hour, the woman's hour will come later. This organization was centered in Boston. It was generally concerned with political rights and quickly became involved with the demand for the vote. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton headed this other group, which was generally a more radical group. Now, these were the women who had fought very hard for the rights of the blacks. They had been very... Anthony and Stanton had both been on platforms. They had been pelleted. They'd been mobbed. But they felt they could not back down on the matter of the changes in the Constitution. So in 1870, Susan B. Anthony voted. In 1870, after these amendments had passed, Susan B. Anthony decided, well, she would test it. She would test it. So she went to the registrar in her home in New York State, and she registered, and she said, the 14th Amendment guarantees rights to all people, and under this, I am claiming my right to vote. And so she registered, and she voted. And a few weeks after, and she brought some other women with her. And a few weeks after that, she was arrested. She was arrested. And she, 1870. She was arrested for voting. And she was brought into court for trial. And it's one of the really great, exciting trials of all time. She's standing before the judge, and at the end, the judge asks her if she has anything to say, and of course she continues to claim that she had the right to vote, she never did anything wrong, and she makes a very stirring speech about these rights. And the judge fined her $100, which she never paid, because there was mounting support for what she'd done. Because of this, and out of this incident, we begin to find that the women's movement is increasingly concerned with the vote.